It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
What up? Money for Lunch. Good to have you guys back here. You know, just bear with me as I'm fixing my equipment here because we were having just a little bit of a challenge this morning. And, okay, that's better. Better for you? I hope so. All right. So, what be happening? Good to have you here. Man, I'm excited because I just got booked to be a speaker at this event, so that's always exciting. And I'm trying to remember what the name of the event is, so I apologize. I was going to give them a plug, but I blew it. Don't know what it is. Anyway, good stuff happening there. Also, I'm excited because we, as the individuals of our lives, the creators of our lives, if we will, the architects of our lives, are in charge, right? So if we want to do whatever it is we want to do, we can go out and do it. We just have to take the courage. We just have to have the courage and take the action, and we can create our lives, right? Whether you want to be an entrepreneur, whether you want to be a writer, whether you want to be an actor, anything that your heart desires can be created by you. Having said that, hey, our first guest today happens to be an actor and an entrepreneur. Colton Tapp, actor and very much an entrepreneur, while his film career has been taking off for some time, he's also had his hands in real estate. Colton's always been business-minded. Colton's latest movie, 3 Days in August, coming out soon. Get it? Because August is just around the corner. Anyway, I don't know. 3 Days in August with veteran actor Barry Bostwick. Oh, good old Barry Bostwick. And generating a lot of buzz with an article in Variety magazine. Colton could talk about his experience in working on this film in Texas. Man, yeah, Texas. And we're going to talk about some other things. You may have seen Colton Tapp in shows like the Boundary with Neil deGrasse Tyson, Die Day, Solar Eclipse, Death Road, Legends and Lies, NCIS New Orleans, and The Front, Salem Blood, On the Highway, and Nightlight. Colton Tapp, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me.
You bet, you bet. All right, so, you know, let's talk about this really quick. You know, sometimes there are actors or creative people, musicians, writers, or whatever, and they don't think of themselves as entrepreneurs. And the reality is you're as entrepreneurial as you get when you're in a creative situation, especially in a highly competitive environment like singing or acting or writing. You know, the cost of entry is minimal, but the competition is fierce.
It is. And it's the way I've always looked at it. I mean, no matter if you're in the arts or if you're in business or if you're in science, I think there's always a sense of entrepreneurship you'll have to carry with you. And it's funny, especially being in the arts, seeing just how many people don't adapt that philosophy and don't adopt it into their lives because it is fierce. And I think people kind of get lost in the art of it completely sometimes. So I've adopted entrepreneurship from my previous businesses into this, and that's kind of how I've always carried it. And so far, it's working for me personally.
Sure, sure. And I think that that's a smart way to look at it. We've had several people here on the show. I've had the pleasure of interviewing, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Jason. Goodness, what's Jason's last name? Come on, somebody. Statham, thank you. Jason Statham. And all of these guys have this entrepreneurial entrepreneurial drive, right? They're always looking for a way to diversify themselves from just being an actor or in the arts, because it is such a, you know, it's a great business when things are going great, but like all businesses, it doesn't hurt to be diversified, because sooner or later, doesn't matter how famous you are, doesn't matter how in demand you are, that fame and that in demand, whether you're a writer or an actor, a business person, a CEO, is short-lived, and sooner or later, you need to make money without having to necessarily be there. I think that's why real estate is such a great option.
Sure. Yeah. Now, I think a lot of people just haven't had the opportunity before they get into the art. Some people start very young, and I mean, some people are lucky enough to have good mentors that do train them about the business of the arts, but other situations, I guess it's hard to learn. It's a hard field to learn entrepreneurship in. It's good to have a background. I was lucky enough to work in a couple other fields while I was building my acting career, and there was no art to that stuff. It was all business, you know, so I was able to kind of carry that with me and apply it to my everyday life now.
Absolutely. Let's talk about this. All right. So let's talk about 3 days in August. So you filmed it in Texas. What is this movie about? Wait a minute. Before you answer that, what part of Texas did you film this in?
Yeah, we shot in Mineral Wells, Texas. Or as the great Marion Hartley says, who was my co-star on there, Miserable Wells, Texas. But, no, it was actually a great town. And we shot it on the ranch right off the Brazos there, where John Wayne used to host his parties and get all of this. It was quite an interesting place. It's a compound. It had, I forget, between 40 and 50 bedrooms, a giant kitchen with two living rooms built into it, and it was quite cool. We shot the entire film in the compound using the yard and the inside of the facility itself. So it was kind of just one big campus where we lived and worked every day.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, that makes it nice. And Mineral Wells. You know, I grew up in Texas. I'm not familiar with that town. Texas is a big state, and there's a lot of small towns, so that's interesting. All right, so now tell us, what is 3 Days in August about?
Yeah, this film's about adoption. It's about specifically my adult mother having identity issues as she's grown up. She's with her family here. I'm her only son with my father and her, and she gets to a point where she's kind of got this final opportunity to get her real parents and her adopted parents to come together for a weekend, 3 days in August is the title. And it becomes this epic battle of personalities. And the parents who have kind of lived this very different life than her more uppity and adopted kind of they were there for her type parents. And she asks the right questions, but also, you know, between the fathers and between the mothers and between me and the grandparent figures, there's all these different dynamics at play, and everybody's kind of got their own motives going on, so it makes for a pretty good ensemble story.
Cool, yeah. You know what, and what's interesting about these types of stories is that it doesn't deal with technology or science, special effects. These types of movies are engaging because of the humanity, right? The personalities you get to know and like these characters. You relate to some of the stuff. I mean, you look at some of these movies where, like Steel Magnolias, an ensemble cast there. And again, no special effects. It was just all about the emotions and the dialogues and the lives of these people. And that's what makes these movies sometimes tougher, because it's just straight humanity versus, let's say, an action movie or a sci-fi movie. Don't you think?
That's right. Yeah, and that makes the writing all much more important. And luckily we had writers who did an incredible job of really capturing what people would feel in that situation. What does a mother who's lived 30, 40 years of her life without knowing her real parents think? How can she solve that identity issue once she has the opportunity to confront both of her sets of parents at the same time? And on top of that, this is a family drama, so it's very clean. It does get grimy, and it does bring out some really harsh truths about the situation, but it's something that everybody can watch and really take something away from. So
that's also good.
Soon. It's coming out in Studio Movie Girls exclusively first, and then we'll see what kind of theatrical release it has from there. But should have a hard date pretty soon, which we'll be putting on IMDb and Facebook.
Excellent, man. Excellent. All right, so let me ask you this. What was the attraction to you for getting involved in acting?
I'm sorry, can you say that one more time?
You bet. What was the attraction to acting? What drew you into the arts?
I just love telling stories. I always have. I was in theater as a kid, and throughout junior high and high school, I was involved in newscasting and made little commercials and skits with my friend. I ended up touring with American Idol and shooting season 7 with them. And I just kind of, I was more involved behind the scenes, but I did do a lot of on-camera type stuff, especially with newscasting. And I just, it grew on me, and it became, I really want to be able to tell these stories that matter and mean something to somebody. I mean, I don't know if you feel the same way, but when you go see an excellent movie, you sit there and you ponder it all night. If you think about it, you have to talk about and discuss and really think about these points that they tried to drive home and say, where's the truth in that? You know, is it applicable to where I'm at in my life right now? And to me, that's just a powerful and scary but important position to be in, to be able to tell those kind of stories. So.
Not only that, but I think that it gives you, you know, when you do certain movies, you know, obviously you're going to learn something. What is it? The one that you did where you were playing, Booth, Wilkes Booth,
yeah,
was his name?
Yeah.
Thank
Hillary
you.
Yeah.
And so Solar Eclipse, I think is what it was called, and that has a movie that has some historical significance, right? You can learn something. You're getting a different point of view, a different perspective that, you know, you're not going to appreciate unless you're doing a play or acting in a movie about that, those events.
Yeah, and I guess it depends on the style of film you're trying to do. This one specifically is more of a narrative than a documentary, so that was especially cool because you actually get to tell the story as if it was happening as opposed to a flashback through documentary style storytelling. So that one's going to be very real and show exactly what kind of characters you were dealing with back then. But yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. All right. So let's talk about real estate. When did you start investing in real estate?
I started right after high school, just here pretty local to my hometown, and I have my realtor license, and that's more the business I focused on after I got out of my previous business was selling real estate, but I do invest, and I do have a couple properties nearby, but I started pretty young, started with a pretty cheap house, and kind of went from there.
Excellent. Yeah, and I think that this, you know, real estate is one of those assets that everybody should have. The fact that you started so young is fantastic, but it's an asset that everybody should have some of, right? Have one or two pieces of real estate. It's a great way to offset inflation. Continue to have income. Passive income. Let me ask you this: when you're dealing with either real estate or, you know, when you're going in for an audition or you're trying to put together a deal, do you have a certain mindset? I mean, because obviously any time that, and I don't care whether you're Donald Duck or Donald Trump, but any time that, at least this is my opinion, any time that you're going to start something new or you're trying to put a deal together, there's a little bit of apprehension, you know, that there's a little bit of fear that tries to stop us a little bit. How do you deal with that?
I think there shouldn't be too much of that. I think if you really know what you're looking for up front and know how to put yourself in that position pre-purchase, then you don't have a whole lot of that concern going into actually writing the check. So, and for me, that's about relationships. That's about being tied into the market you want to invest in, which is why, as I mentioned, I specifically invest locally to where I'm originally from, because I know the market, I know how it's changed, I know how it will be changing based on the politics of the local town and based on the activity of real estate sales themselves and businesses coming in. So, you know, if you know these things and at the same time you're able to keep an ear on the ground and know when something's going to be coming up for sale, know when somebody's having trouble taking care of a property and might be putting it up for sale soon, things like that from the market, and would be simply shopping through a realtor or simply shopping online or something like that, you know. So I think just being connected in those ways helps out tremendously on the front end.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and I like what you said there. First of all, you've said it a couple of times, so I just want to kind of point it out that, you know, you've been focused on your local market because it's what you know, it's where you're at. And I think that is one of the big tips that a lot of people, miss. I know a lot of people who, instead of starting in their home, in their local area, have gotten involved and have bought real estate outside of their local area. And I want to say it seems like 90% of these deals have some kind of issues with them. I sat down with Robert Kiyosaki a couple of years ago, and he said the same thing. He says he tends to buy in his local area. Why? Because that's where he jogs. That's where he's walking through. He knows the area. He sees what's happening, and he can make a determination based on what he knows is real. And so this is great advice, and I think it's something that everybody should keep in mind. There's nothing wrong with going outside of your market, but you really should start locally, and then from there, see if you really need to expand out of your market.
Yeah, I mean, I've had opportunities where I've got friends in other cities, you know, throughout Texas or whatnot, maybe in Houston, San Antonio, where you hear them talking about how great the market is there and about certain things moving and happening, but you know, if I were to do that, not only am I not as familiar as them, but I don't have the same political stance in that city that I do here locally. I don't jog in those neighborhoods, like you said. And at the same time, once you make a purchase, do you really want to have to put up the expenses or be making the travel commitments to go out there and take care of these things? Because issues will arise. I mean, they always do. Hopefully they're small ones most of the time. But if it's in your backyard, it just doesn't require that kind of financial and time commitment to handle something quickly if you need to. So I think all around it's a good idea to, especially starting off, keep it smaller, keep it local, and just figure it out first, you know, and make sure you're not putting yourself in a position where you have to be worried, where you do lose sleep at night. So.
Right. One of the things that Robert Kiyosaki taught me, and I thought this was smart, and that is, if you're going to buy real estate or invest real estate in, out of your market, make sure that it's a place that you either want to go visit, such a, you know, vacation spot. So buy in an area where you're either going to want to go travel there so you can write it off, a place where. Sorry about that. I had a sneeze really bad, so I had to hit the cough button, and hopefully I hit it in time. But anyway, he was talking about, yeah, if you're going to buy out of your market, go to, you know, buy in an area that you like to vacation. You know, it gives you a reason to go there, check on your property. It gives you an additional tax write-off. So maybe it's an area where your grandkids live or where your kids live, or it's your favorite vacation spot. And he says that's a great taking care of two for the price of one. So you get to go to your favorite place, you get to check on your real estate, and a portion of that is tax deductible. All right, so let's talk about this rejection, because rejection is something that we all deal with, but specifically in the acting world, you guys deal with an incredible amount of rejection. So how do you deal with that? How do you deal with rejection? You know, here's your part, maybe you've done the audition, you met with the people, they really like you, and then at the last minute they go with somebody else. So how do you deal with rejection?
Well, for one, you just have to absolutely be able to turn off that mindset and say, even though this is about my personal self, this is me walking in there and being vulnerable, it's the business side of you, and it's the part that anybody that cares about that's making these decisions is ultimately the production and the money and getting the thing done. So you just have to know that. And I also think it kind of ties back into what we were just talking about with preparation and kind of knowing what you're getting into before you do it. I mean, if you're prepared as an actor, but with anything where you're dealing with rejection, and you know that you've got your stuff lined up, you know you've got the way you look worked out, the way you're going to go in there and perform worked out, and the substance that you're bringing to the table workout, then you don't have to really worry about it. You just go in there and you perform the way that you planned and practiced. And if they don't need you right then, they don't need you right then. But, you know, I consider every no to hide a little nugget of truth in it about maybe what you could have done differently for this particular audience, or maybe you couldn't have done anything, you know? I mean, you always want to improve and take something away, but sometimes it really is just about the color of your hair, the color of your skin, something like that. So
sure.
I think you just have to kind of, you got to kind of keep all those things in mind and just go in there and be calm and handle it. It's not much different from real estate sales, honestly. When I got into acting full-time, it was simply a transition of from being rejected often from people who are buying homes to now it's people who are casting you for a movie. But I think it's very similar to any sales-driven job.
Right. I mean, you know, bottom line is, like you said, there's – in some cases, like you said, there's a nugget of truth in there where maybe you can go back and look at what you could have done better. There's nothing wrong with reflection. And then especially whether you're selling real estate, buying real estate, or in an acting situation, they just found a better fit. Doesn't mean that you were bad. Doesn't mean that you could have done anything better. Bottom line is they found a better fit, you know, and I think that a great example of that is Tom Selleck at one point, and I know for some of our audience, Tom Selleck, they may be going, who? But Tom Selleck was at one point asked to be Indiana Jones. And because at that time he was filming, I think, you know, Magnum P.I. or some other movie, he couldn't do it. And so then Harrison Ford got it. And yeah. And so, Matt, you know, what's his name? Tom Selleck will tell you Harrison Ford is Indiana Jones. He says, as much as I would have loved to do it, I would not have been the Indiana Jones that everybody fell in love with. And it just, you know, in that situation there, things worked out, and I think that for the best. So, you know, it happens to everybody at every level. Again, whether you're Donald Duck or Donald Trump, not everybody's going to accept you. Not everybody's going to take your deal. And it's just part of life. And I think the better you're suited, I want to get your opinion on this, the better you are able to deal with rejection, you know, the faster you can roll through life and get on to the next deal.
That's absolutely right. I think it's also important to be willing to put yourself out there, even if you think it's not going to work out sometimes. I mean, obviously, if you could, every deal that's going to be a yes and just target those, you'd probably go ahead and do that. But, you know, I think some great opportunities come from going out there and putting yourself in the face of rejection for opportunities that probably won't work for you. You know, I've been called in and acting for roles that didn't sound anything like the character I would typically play, didn't even sound physically like my type. And the casting director sit there and look at you and see you perform, and they say, well, what if this character was more like that instead of what we had in our mind, you know? And then you do get stuff like that. And then things that are perfect for you, you go in there and you do it, and you're like, there's no way I'm not getting that, and you never hear from them again. So,
yeah
I think you just got to be prepared, like you said. You got to go in there with your stuff lined up, but also understand that there's variables that are beyond your control, and sometimes – other people know exactly what to do with you, and you just got to kind of trust that process. So.
Absolutely. You know, you reminded me, we had a while back, a couple of months ago, Tom Arnold, my wife and I went out and had dinner with Tom Arnold. Him and I have a mutual friend, and anyway, they set us up to go have lunch, or I'm sorry, dinner with Tom Arnold. He was in town for a show. Anyway, one of the great stories that Tom Arnold talked about, and this goes back to what you said about putting yourself out there, even though you're not going to get it. He had gotten a call to play in the movie True Lies with Schwarzenegger, and he knew he wasn't going to get the part. It wasn't, you know, this is like his first major movie. I think it was his second acting job. He's you know, he was chubby for that movie. He wasn't your typical spy looking, you know, action figure type guy. And he says, I knew I wasn't going to get it, but I wasn't going to let the opportunity pass me by. So I went on through the audition, and then they had me meet with the director, what is it, John Cameron or whatever the guy's name is. And he knew that he wasn't going to get it. And he says, I was so sure I wasn't going to get it that I told Cameron, listen, you know, why are you guys talking to me? I mean, there's like a dozen other better people than me out there. You know, I look like crap. I have no experience. You know, what's all this about? And because he was willing to go through the process, he was willing to take the pain of being rejected. He ended up getting the part. You know, it was a successful part for him. It's probably one of his better roles. So it goes to show you, even though you think you know you're going to get rejected or it's not going to work out, you go for it. Worst case scenario, it doesn't work out just like you expected, so no big deal. But best case scenario, something happens. You meet somebody you weren't expecting. You get the part. Maybe you get the other part that somebody wanted you for. So there's no harm, no foul by going for something that you think is out of your league.
Well, and there's the other part of that is maybe they didn't hire him for that role, but now they know that they like him. They know he's got a character that they can use in the future, and there's prospect there. You know, you've got yourself something potentially lined up in the future while you're still out there working on other things. So, and that happens all the time in any type of sales, I guess, especially acting, where the casting director now knows how they can apply you to a role, and you've got that relationship. So you just got to go in there with – really, I try to land every role that I go in for, but you got to just kind of say to yourself, this is a sales pitch for the future. You know, I mean, they may or may not ever use me for this, but these people are going to cast 50 to 100 more films throughout the next year or two, and now I've been in their door and had a relationship with them. So I think that applies to most sales.
Yeah, no, I think you hit the nail right on the spot. Everything comes down to relationships, right? I mean, if you and I are friends, or if you and I have some type of relationship, I'm casting a movie, chances are Colton Tapp is going to be on my short list. Hey, I think, I like this guy. You know, I like his style. There's a relationship there. So let's see where we can put him in the movie. I think that people sometimes overlook the importance of a relationship. You know, you can't take a rejection personally. And it never hurts to build a relationship because, like you said, they're going to cast other movies. You never know where it's going to go. And I think everybody's experienced they have a relationship with somebody at a casting company or in another company, and that individual gets fired from that company. They go off someplace else, and they all of a sudden reach out to you to do business with that new company. Because you have that relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I still get people calling me quite a bit for real estate stuff, you know, even though I'm traveling quite a bit right now, so it's a little bit harder to keep my feet planted in the market I'm from. But, you know, I worked with them on previous investment deals, and they know that by staying in touch with me, being from the hometown and, you know, working with the mayor of my home city and being connected to the business owners of the town, that relationship is going to potentially bring future investment deals to them. And so, you know, that definitely applies to real estate. I think even when I'm on the investment side, I'm calling up and dropping by and seeing anybody who would ever know anything about something in town, you know? So I think just going in there and utilizing those relationships and making sure that they're staying in contact with you is key.
Absolutely, absolutely. All right, so the movie is coming out in the next couple of months? Or we don't have a time yet?
3 days in August?
Yeah, 3 days in August, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that one, it should be sometime in August, I believe, but I don't have a hard date. I don't want to promise you that, but it's finishing off its festival runs right now. I believe it's in Toronto doing a film festival out there. So as soon as it wraps up that one, it's going to be ready to hit the theaters, and hopefully everybody can go check it out. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and again, it's got Barry Boswick. He's excellent. Love him in everything I've seen him in. And then it also has another co-host, Marriott Hartley, Marriott Hart, that sounds familiar. Where is she at? What has she done?
She has been around. She was I forget if it was Polaroid or Kodak, but for a long time she was the camera girl. So Meg Foster, though, is a name that's rising very rapidly. She's got some TV shows going on right now, and she's also been around in specifically the horror kind of market for many years, and she plays just this tremendous character. She's actually the real mom who put my mom up for adoption, and her take on why she did it and what her world's been like just really almost brings you to your knees. You're like, wow, this is very harsh, you know, about why somebody would do that. How could they put up their baby for adoption? But she really kind of tells that story about how it happens. So.
Sure. Yeah, Marriott Hartley. Yeah, in fact, I think she you're right. She's been in a lot. Some of you guys may remember she had a TV series. She's done an enormous amount. And Meg Foster, I'm not familiar with, but I'll check her out. And then just real quick, I want to mention this. Big kudos to you. Congratulations. You won Best Actor in the Dallas Horror Film Festival. That had to be kind of a pleasant little surprise. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. That was a surprise. It was a lot of fun. It was actually a pretty quick project that me and some people from Texas threw together, and we shot it pretty quick, but we just kind of had the right pieces together, and it turned out okay. That one's actually available to watch on my coldentap.com. I typically put up any recent short films on there for watch, and that one is right there under shorts. So you can click on that and check it out. It's about 6 or 7 minutes long, but yeah, it was a lot of fun.
I love it. I love it. Well, hey, Colton, it's been a blast having you on the show. Looking forward to having you back again, talking about your movies, your projects, real estate, or success. Guys, you can check out his latest projects, including this short film, at ColtonTapp.com. Colton Tapp, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you. Talk to you soon. Bye.
All right. Good stuff there from Colton Tapp. You know, I can say best actor. And just coming out with 3 Days in August is his latest film, shot there in Texas. And so, yeah, Best Actor for the Dallas Horror Film Festival. Something, again, that he shot in a very short amount of time, just him and some friends, and boom, it worked out really well for him. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro
and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. My next guest, David Ackerman. David Ackerman is Chief Compliance Officer at Sound Income Strategies. And like a lot of people, he has been watching this event unfold between Miami suing Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup over what they have claimed to be continuous pattern of practice of mortgage discrimination in Miami, predatory-type lending tactics. This is a neat event, and David Ackerman, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thanks so much, Bert. Great to be here.
Yeah, you and I were talking right before the show started here, and a lot of people are watching this. It is, when I say a neat event, neat in the sense that it's a historic event for a city, Miami, taking on, essentially three of the biggest banks in the world.
Oh, absolutely. And I have to give them a lot of credit because they're doing it in a very creative way by using the Fair Housing Act, which I'm sure many of your listeners are more familiar with, is what prevents discrimination in mortgage lending, in how you rent a home or sell a house to a particular type of individual. It's meant to prevent that type of discrimination.
Okay, so walk us through this. So in this particular lawsuit, they sued back in, was it 2013? And they, as you mentioned, they accused the bank of discrimination using this fair housing law. And so walk us through, what happened with the original lawsuit? Where is it at today?
Originally, what they were claiming is the city sued the banks under this Fair Housing Act, claiming that, as you had appropriately said before, discrimination in mortgage practices. Now, normally, you might be thinking that, okay, how does that relate to the city and not the individual? What the city is trying to claim is that they lost revenue because of this discrimination. So they lost revenue in the sense that many houses were foreclosed upon because of these actions. The city had to acquire a lot of these properties and then maintain them, so they lost money that way. So they lost tax revenues, they lost revenues that they wouldn't have had to pay to maintain these houses, things of that nature. And that's the claim that they're trying to make. And originally, when they started, the lower court heard their arguments, and I noticed when I read the decision that it almost seemed like the judge, when he was writing it, was impressed with the way the city proposed the argument. But originally he said you can't sue. Then they appealed, the city appealed, and the appellate court is the one that said, actually, yes, you can sue. So now this has gotten the attention of the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has decided to hear the case because Miami's not the only one that's thinking this way. There's several cities that have similar lawsuits. So the court is probably going to weigh in on what they think, how they think, and try to give the other courts in the country a little bit of guidance on how to handle this.
Yeah, this is interesting. This is, as I mentioned earlier, this is historic. Now, one of the issues that Miami has to deal with is that this law is typically or was meant to be for people suing banks, not municipality suing banks, right?
Right. It's actually unclear, and that's why the Supreme Court is going to take up the reins on this. The original intention was really just to prevent discrimination. So if you have a minority community, you want to make sure that they are treated exactly the same way as any other community in the country. And you want to ensure that they are not getting taken advantage of because maybe there's not that much money in the area, or it's underserved in some capacity. So it's really, the original intention was to protect the consumer. However, and this is where it really gets interesting, and this is where I give a lot of credit to the city of Miami, they never actually define what is a quote-unquote aggrieved person under the law. So what the city of Miami is trying to claim is that if corporations are people, why not cities? And it's incredibly clever. However, at the end of the day, I really don't believe that this is the proper way to fix the situation with the individual municipalities, especially with the city of Miami.
All right. So what are your thoughts? How should this be rectified?
It may surprise a lot of your listeners that even though I am the chief compliance officer for an investment bank, I'm actually very pro-regulation or proper regulation. And what I think a lot of people don't realize is that the finance industry is one of the most heavily regulated industries in our country. It's up there with medicine. So any one particular investment bank is going to have five to six different regulators, each one of them with the ability to punish bad behavior. And the reason I mention that is I think this would be a completely different scenario if the money that was collected was going back to the people who were harmed. But that's not the case. The city is trying to recoup the money for the city, not for the people. So my inclination is, and I've been following this pretty carefully, is that even though a lot of people still have a bad taste in their mouth after 2008, and rightfully so, you know, I treat every investor like they're my mother, and I do so because I believe in our system. But the city is not going after the banks to help the people who were harmed. They're going after it to help themselves. And that's where I think their argument falls short, because that's taxation by another name. That's not – if you're trying to harm the banks or protect the city, we have regulators to do that already. And I'll give you my personal take, and this is an argument that I use often. People may despise what the banks have done, and people may still be upset that no one went to jail. But technically speaking, nobody did anything illegal. It was immoral, it was egregious, and it was unethical, but it wasn't illegal. And they changed that in 2008 with Dodd-Frank. At the end of the day, though, with all of the different alphabet soup of regulators that we have, the system works. When everyone else in the world is fighting or has a problem or has an economic crisis, people bring their money here. So people may not necessarily like the speed at which it goes with regulators and with fines and things of that nature. However, it works. So to have the cities get compensated in a different form, I don't feel is the proper way to really attack this scenario.
Yeah, you know, now that you lay it out like that, I kind of have to agree with you. I mean,
well, we're lawyers. That's what we do.
I mean, you're right. It would be fantastic if the city was saying, "Hey, we're doing this not only just for the city, but for on behalf of our constituents to help, you know, to make them whole, to help them do something." But you're right. They're just doing it because, A, they need money, and this is a creative way of getting it. No doubt. This is smart on their part. This is kind of like a class action lawsuit without a class.
Yeah, actually, I think that's an excellent way of describing it. And I can almost guarantee, because the problem with the financial crisis and the housing crisis and the housing bubble, it's so far-reaching. I guarantee there's a few listeners out there right now who were harmed by this, maybe even had their house foreclosed on. Imagine if you were in that position and you hear that your city is going after the banks to try to recoup some of that money, and then finding out later that you're not going to get a dime of it. That actually goes to the city. So
right.
It's – unfortunately, it's a really big dichotomy between – there are a lot of people who do not want big government, who don't want government intervention, who want less taxes. And then there's a lot of people who just really want to see the banks punished. And as much as I can understand both camps, it's really important to realize that especially a case like this has far-reaching implications. You don't want to discourage banks from lending in minority areas. You don't want to discourage banks from going in and setting up shop in areas that are underrepresented. If they're able to be taxed by a municipality through an act like the Fair Housing Act, which was really meant to help stop discrimination, then the implications of that are too far-reaching for anyone to even contemplate. So, and that's my real fear. And eventually, I think that's what the Supreme Court is going to focus in on and kind of hone in and define a little bit better, is who is an aggrieved person. And in my particular opinion, I don't think they're going to find that a municipality like the city is.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? It's just, you know, I kind of really, at first, I really liked this. I really liked Miami taking on the banks. But now that you're right, that the fact that they're not going to really help anybody out, it's just going to go to them. And, you know, it just, to me, and now the lawsuit's completely flat. It has no meaning to me. I mean, it's going to open up. It's going to open up, I think, a can of worms for other municipalities, and it may even open up, I don't know, some other type of class action. But it's almost, I don't know, it's just, it's almost worthless.
And I agree with you. And I actually had the exact same reaction when I first saw this. I'm thinking in my head, that's brilliant. Why aren't more cities approaching the same thing? Because the city of Miami has such a large Hispanic and minority population that
sure.
They were hit hard. They were hit really hard. So this sounded like a really clever way to kind of recoup some of those losses. But I mean, I don't think it's a total loss. I think it's a great first attempt. And what I'm hoping is, and one of the reasons why I'm really advocating speaking out about this particular issue, there are a number of cities across the country that are in the same position that Miami was in. And just because this argument may fail, it doesn't mean that there is another one that can work. And I think if we take some of the lessons learned, and look, I could be completely wrong and Supreme Court could turn around and say, yeah, go for it. You can sue. But if that doesn't work, there is a possibility of, let's say, having a city set up a fund for people who were injured. And the purpose of that fund will be to pay back taxes or something along those lines. I'm almost positive that, you know, you get enough smart people in a room, you're going to figure out a way to make it work. But the way the city of Miami is currently doing it, it's just, it's taxation by another name, and it's really not helping anybody but the city. So it's a sticky situation. It's a difficult thing because it's hard to know what side to fall on, because you don't want to, you know, argue against the populace, but at the same time, you really don't want government overreaching, especially with something that was designed to dissuade discrimination.
Yeah. No, and I think that you're right. I think that if they said, hey, we're going to put this in a fund, we're going to help, you know, pay back taxes, because ultimately, doesn't that make the most sense? Because that's all those back taxes go to Miami anyway.
Right.
And, so that would be the ideal situation. Hey, if we win, we're going to pay off everybody's back taxes. We get the revenue, so it's a win-win for all of us.
Yeah, and I think there's a number of different ways. Like I said, if there's other municipalities that are watching this case. So, for example, let's say the town forecloses on your home for unpaid taxes. There's nothing saying that if the city sues and wins money and they put it into a fund, and that fund then gets distributed to, you know, a select group that gets a pro rata portion of what's collected, and the city is agreeing to settle the tax deed lawsuit for whatever amount of money is collected, everybody wins. People get to keep their homes. The city gets something as opposed to nothing. But as of right now, that's not how they're approaching it. So there are lessons to be learned here. I'm just hoping that they don't close the door completely on this.
Yeah. You know what? Because this, if they don't do something like that, this is going to add, really, it's going to add insult to injury. Because you could see Miami saying, hey, we got all this money. Let's just say they prevail. They get millions of dollars. And if they don't let the citizens off the hook, this is just really abusive. Now it seems like the citizens would have to sue Miami get from under this, because they're looking to get paid twice is what it looks like.
Again, I'm sure a lot of the listeners have a lot of passionate feelings about this because they were themselves harmed. But
right.
For instance, the SEC when they levy a fine, there's a certain percentage of that fine that goes into a pretty much like a giant account. And
right.
people who were harmed can kind of petition that account and show their proof and get some money back. It's not going to be a lot. It's definitely not going to be how much you lost, but it's something. So setting up a system like that may give their arguments a little bit more credibility. But again, you run into that one problem where you don't want to be taxing through another form or another way and kind of put even more stress on the system than it already is. So as much as people would love to see the banks get punished and punished and pummeled, which they have been to the tunes of billions of dollars, and rightfully so in my opinion,
sure.
This may not necessarily be the smartest move because it also can open up a Pandora's box. And this is just one person's opinion. There are people on the other side of this issue that think it's that the case should go forward. So really what they're only deciding on is whether or not the city is allowed to sue under this particular law. That's it.
Right.
So, but in court terms, if you're allowed to sue, you're going to settle. That's 95% of the cases get settled. So it's really
yeah,
saying how much are you looking for? So,
yeah, no, that's great. That's great. All right. So first of all, now this case is before the Supreme Court of the United States. Do they have a time limit? My understanding is that they don't necessarily have a time limit. Am I right?
No, they have it scheduled. Truth be told, I don't remember when it's scheduled to be heard. But the way it typically works is both sides will then submit their documents, their appeals, so to speak, and the court can hear oral arguments, which the advocates then have time to essentially state their case to the individual judges. So, I mean, this is one of the most incredible experiences for a lawyer you could possibly have, but B, you've got some of the greatest legal minds in the world firing questions at you constantly, trying to kind of come up to the most reasonable solution under the law. So, there is really no way of knowing, you know, in quotes, what they're going to end up doing. But in about a year, we'll find out. I'm sure there'll be other lawsuits that'll be filed in that time, possibly with some revisions. But in that time, we'll see a lot of changes. We're going to see changes to Dodd-Frank. I mean, with the election, you never know what's going to happen because if the government changes the law, that is also going to affect things. So it's something to definitely keep an eye on individually and collectively.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. No, this is, again, a very historic lawsuit. It could affect a lot of people. It's going to be interesting to watch. And David, I'd love to bring you back once the once SCOTUS makes their decision. Bring it back, get your insights and your thoughts on it, and go from there.
That would be great. Let's hope I was right, because then I would, you know, avoid the egg on my face.
Either way, it'll make a great discussion.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having me, though. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Good stuff there from David Ackerman about this lawsuit, Miami versus the three banks. It's an amazing, amazing attempt by the city to, as it says, make itself whole from all the money it supposedly lost. It's just an interesting situation. Anyway, always good to have you guys here. As always, we appreciate your suggestions, your ideas. I love the fact that you guys interact with me on Twitter and on Facebook and now on Instagram. Thank you so much. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.